Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to this very special Captain America: The Winter Soldier spoiler podcast. Over the next hour or so, we'll be discussing Marvel's latest movie, in which Captain America, played by Chris Evans, of course, faces off against a threat from his past while battling a conspiracy within S.H.I.E.L.D. in extraordinary depth. For this one has, perhaps more than any other Phase 2 movies thus far, has huge ramifications for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Needless to say, as ever, this is hugely spoilerific. We'll be discussing all the movie's revelations, third act stuff, and all. So if you haven't yet seen Cap 2, hie thee to your nearest cinema, rectify that immediately, and then come back here for oral pleasure. Joining me to natter on about it are Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And Ali Plum.
Good, hello.
Good there, so you can actually distinguish which one's Helen.
Yes, me.
And which one's Ali.
Her.
Helen.
Ali.
Ali, okay. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of the latest outing for Steve Rogers and his amazing friends, let's hear from the two men who directed the movie, Anthony and Joe Russo, making a return to the big screen after a decade or so spent directing the likes of Arrested Development and Community on the small, popped into the pod booth recently to talk about major upheaval at S.H.I.E.L.D., talking computers, and much, much more. So, congratulations, guys. You have succeeded where Hydra failed, and you have brought down S.H.I.E.L.D.
Thank you.
How does that feel?
Feels fantastic. I mean, listen, it was great. You know, it's great to have a film like this that has something so dramatic at the end of it, such a dramatic shift in the MCU. It creates a lot of energy and attention around the movie, but also it was great. It was great for storytelling.
Absolutely. Was that always the plan when you came on board? Or
yeah, that was in place before we got involved with the project. There was an excellent script, which was really such a gift. Marcus McFeely wrote a great script. Kevin had a lot of really strong ideas he wanted in there. You know, we did do a lot of work with the guys once we got on board. We had about 8 months to polish the script, came up with a lot of the action set pieces, you know, brought a De Palma-esque influence to some of the tension moments. So we were able to work out all that stuff together. But they, you know, that is the way that Kevin operates. He's got big ideas that he likes to see in the film. And he just says, listen, go crazy. Just let's just make sure that at the end of the S.H.I.E.L.D. is no longer.
So so as guys who are very, very closely associated with several TV shows, including obviously Arrested Development and Community, did it, I don't know, give you a sort of perverse pleasure knowing that you would be effectively torpedoing another TV show, an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., with what you were doing on this one? Is that your plan to take out the rivals one by one as you go along?
It wasn't our plan, but we were... We were anxious about it the first time we showed the movie because, you know, Marvel's very secretive. So, you know, you sort of, everything's kind of on a need-to-know basis. So when the moment finally came where the cast and writers of the show needed to see that what was happening in this movie and they saw an edit, there was sort of an ashen kind of effect on everybody at the end of the screening in terms of maybe they're thinking about their futures. But
yeah. Holy shit, we're out of a job.
Yeah. How much like Marvel is S.H.I.E.L.D.?
It's loosely based on Marvel.
Loosely, though.
There's a red dot in your chest.
My heart just exploded.
Is Jenny Agata alive?
Is she alive? Yes, she's alive. Yeah, it was very funny because we talked about that. We were like, well, is the audience going to think that they killed her and that Scarlett carved her face off? Are they going to, you know, what are they going to think happened here? But, you know, clearly we tried to set her up earlier as that she was, you know, vaguely benevolent.
Yeah.
As benevolent as somebody on the WSC could be, so that maybe that was the inroad into her character as they felt they could get to her and that she would play ball.
We probably should have included her, though, somewhere at the end so people knew.
We had talked about, we talked about putting her in the, you know, there's a scene with Scarlett where she's talking to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and we talked about putting her in that scene so you knew that she was, you know, sitting near Scarlett or something. I mean, you know. Part of the testimony or something, and then we're like, oh, you know, let people argue.
Have you considered maybe having a post credit sting? So maybe after the film is finished, then there's 15 minutes of blackness,
there may be time to add one more.
Jenny Agata having a cup of tea.
Yeah. We did bring in a rep from the Guinness Book of World Records. We were trying to break the record for most endings in a film. I think we have 7 endings.
I think Return record. Of the King still got you.
Okay, God, it does. Okay, that was 11 endings.
roughly in that ballpark. There are so many things that you do in this movie. Were you associated, I guess, with the main post credit sting, or was that Joss?
That was exclusively Joss. He wrote it, he shot it.
Those are characters that, you know, are in the Avengers. That was basically the very beginning of that narrative.
And they were all in London, and you know, it was just very. But that's the way. Honestly, that's what we love about working at Marvel is this interconnectedness between all these really cool writers and directors, and you know, people handing off ideas, and you know. He was very complimentary when he saw the movie Joss, and very supportive, And I think he loved the 2:3:5 aspect ratio, and I think they're going to use that now on Avengers 2. So it's great because everybody has sort of a give and take, and you know, with each other.
There were several, you know, rumors on the internet that basically just worth ignoring. But one was that Robert Redford's character was going to be a bad guy. No. That he was going to be Red Skull.
Yeah.
Now, when you saw those, did you think, hang on, we actually considered that, or was it just pish?
Well, this, you know, the tonal approach that we took to this movie was we wanted to, you know, for many reasons, our jumping off point for it was, you know, what is special about Captain America? And it's like, he doesn't fly across the sky like Iron Man. He doesn't turn into a green monster like Hulk. He doesn't come from another world like Thor. He's a guy, only maybe a little more so. So we wanted to come up with a style that kind of that suited him and celebrated him, and that was very different from where he started in the 40s, where that first movie kicked him off. Though it did it very well, it's just he's in a different place now. So we came up with we wanted to do a realism approach to a superhero movie to the degree that you can. Part of our sort of creative process is we like combining incongruous ideas. Like, you know, like you see that in Arrested Development with like sort of absurdism, an absurdist world, you know, shot in a mockumentary style. Yeah, and similarly here, you know, what does it mean to do a realistic version of a superhero movie? So, I forgot where I was going with all this. What was your question?
Red Skull.
Here's how we never crossed paths with Red Skull on this movie. Because we were trying to do a more grounded approach, we sort of took as much all the sci-fi elements off the table as we could. We tried to draw upon more real-world influences and inspiration.
Which is why we put Zola in a computer, because we felt that people would really... There was no sci-fi in it. And that was a big problem, that scene, actually, for months on this movie. We probably just finished that scene 2 weeks ago.
Really?
In the edit room. Finally did the final draft of what Zola actually said. It maybe changed 30 or 40 times.
Yeah.
But, you know, because you're in this espionage / paranoid thriller that is grounded and shot verite in his handheld cameras. And, you know, Cap feels more real world. And then suddenly the movie screeches to a halt when you switch gears really quickly into a guy, you know, a ghost in the machine, a character in a computer in a basement. You know,
but it's a very grounded guy in a computer. Yeah,
they're very old computers. Yes.
But imagine if you had Red Skull at the end of the film. You know, I feel like Zola takes a leap of faith on the audience's part. They're like, wait a minute, we're shifting genres really quickly here. What's going on? And if it turned out to be Skull, I think it might have jumped the rails at the end of the movie.
Did I hear I think. A War Games reference there?
There's a War Games
reference. There is, yeah.
Was that from you? Was that in the script?
Yeah, that was us and Marcus.
It wasn't in the original
script,
yeah.
On set. I think we wrote that joke literally 5 minutes before we shot it. Yeah. Sometimes you're shooting a scene and you get the sense that it's playing a little dry or a little straight.
Yeah.
And you go, and also we felt like, let's invite the audience in on what this is. They'll get a War Games reference and then they'll understand that the scene is a talking computer, right? Oh, we've seen this before in movies, right? So if we're ironic or self-referential, maybe it's a way we can earn some trust from them as far as the execution of the scene.
But at the end of the day, I mean, look, the movie is, you know, there's a sci-fi nature to it. It's inescapable because you're dealing with a guy who was born as a 90-pound weakling, turned into a super soldier, and then frozen for 70 years. So, you know, it's just where do you lie on the spectrum? You know, where are you on the spectrum? And on that spectrum, we wanted to try to stay sort of to one side of it. Yeah,
absolutely. I have to say, I'm fully on board with the decision not to have Pierce become the Red Skull at the end of the movie. I was kind of willing him not to rip off his face.
Right.
You guys do go so far down that road of setting up, you know, you have the lift sequence, which is phenomenal. Right. And it does feel like a very, like you say, very, very grounded version of a superhero movie, right from the off. And Pierce is a really, really good villain because he's completely and utterly human.
Mm-hmm.
And in almost, in some ways, weirdly relatable.
Right. Yeah. That's what we tried to do with him. I mean, listen, the whole, you know, the movie The whole NSA stuff went down after we started rolling cameras on the movie, but, you know, we wanted to rip stuff from the headlines, and these are the things we obsess about every day. I'm on Dig and Huffington Post and BuzzFeed and CNN, and, you know, I'm reading this news every day and absorbing these things going, well, shit, these are my anxieties about the world, or, you know, what do we do with protecting ourselves, and but at the same time, how do we, you know, how do we draw a line in the sand in respect to our civil liberties and, you know, preemptive strikes. And,
yeah.
You know, so is there a way to protect ourselves humanely? Becoming ever complicated. So it was important for us that you relate to Pierce's point of view, because what he's saying is for us, some sort of philosophical extrapolation of where we're headed.
Yeah.
You know, so we wanted you to go, holy shit, that well, you know, that's not, in 100 years, maybe that's, not so far-fetched.
Mm. It's funny you say, you make this movie, start making this movie, then the NSA thing happens. I'm just hoping, you know, halfway through Avengers 2, a giant robot
right.
doesn't crash onto Earth and start wreaking havoc. Going back to you saying that you wrote the War Games line just 5 minutes before, mm-hmm. did you, is there a chance that you wrote the Stephen Strange reference when it slipped in 5 minutes before, or was that in the script?
That was always in. That was in early,
that was
right?
in early draft. No,
well, I think we put it, was it in the room.
Oh, here was, I feel like it was in and then it was out and then it was in.
Do you remember when we were working on the script? He didn't have that speech that well. We created right. that scene when we were trying to figure out a way that, you know, we didn't want Zola to give them everything. We wanted Zola to give them enough that they then had to go to someone else and actually, you know, actively do something to get the rest of the information. But I remember, you know, we are comic book geeks. I've been collecting since I was 10. And I remember trying to throw references into that speech. And one of them was Stephen Strange. And it sat there, because I love Doctor Strange, it sat there forever. And it was in the edit forever. And I kept thinking, Kevin is going to come to us one day and he's going to go, you can't put Stephen Strange. Like, we haven't even introduced him yet. So I remember we're sitting on the mix stage and I started to feel guilty. And I said to Kevin, I said, are you sure you want us to keep that Stephen Strange reference in the movie? It was the first time we talked about the reference. And he said, fuck yeah, why not? He goes, so people don't know when in the time, you know, on the timeline when he gets introduced. He could have been introduced already. And, you know, so when the movie comes out, you know, the movie could take place, you know, a year or two before this. So
if he were to be introduced.
If he were to be introduced. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wonder if he will be at some point. I'm curious.
I've got a similar thought with the Bruce Banner thing. Because we've got to talk about Nick Fury, don't we?
Yes.
For a number of reasons. How did he pick his sunglasses? All that sort of thing. But when that reference of the pulse deepening thing, I feel like that's a very clever interconnection that we've been talking about earlier. Well, again, was that your idea or was that a script thing?
That was
in the script.
That was Marcus and McFeely's idea. Yeah. I think that was Fury stuff. It's so hard. There's so many iterations of the script. It's hard to remember when all this stuff came in, but that was definitely Marcus and McFeely's idea. But that was something I think that came up after a couple of rewrites.
Okay. Yeah.
And again, the references to Tony Stark and the repulsor engines on the helicopter.
That was always in.
That's a lovely little touch. But was Fury always meant to rise from the grave, Lazarus-esque?
Again, when we entered the process, that was already in the script. So I never heard that I never heard the history of how they got there.
It seemed,
as far as we know, it was always supposed to be.
Okay.
Yeah. Someone, maybe not in Captain America 3, has to die.
Yes, somewhere at some point.
Eventually.
So look at, contracts are going to be up soon. There might be a lot of dead characters in the
I think Sam Jackson signed for about 47 movies, so I think he might be okay, but there might be some other ones.
No, I think 2050 was, they just changed the contract, it's still 2050.
There are some interesting setups, obviously, for Captain America 3, which has been announced for 2 years hence. So it's, you've got to,
clock's ticking.
You've got to get on it, guys.
We're sweating it.
Where are you right now with that movie?
We've had a lot of discussions.
Sitting here, not working on it.
I'm so sorry.
Okay.
We had a lot of discussions with Marcus and McFeely. It would come up on set every now and then. You know, everybody has a general sense of the direction that we want to move in. You know, and the most that we can say about it at this point is clearly when you see this film, Bucky's story is not finished, right? Mm. It's an introduction to Bucky's story. So if you want to guess at what that movie could be about, you could assume that there would be a continuation of Bucky's story.
I'm a huge Community fan, and I've got to ask, did Danny beg? Was he like, I need to be in this movie. Please let me be in this movie.
I think we begged him. It was one of the things where it just felt, look, we love Easter eggs, right? So we love, Redford opens the fridge. There's
don't give him away.
Oh, I got to give that away.
It's a fun one. What's fun?
It's like a Newman's Own dressing in there. You know, it's like little, you know, the gravestone at the end of the movie.
We
like to put, you know, you can see from Arrested Development community, we like layers. I love that when somebody watches the movie for the second or third time, they go, oh my God, I've never seen that before. That is really interesting. Or, you know, and so it was a nod to all the fans. And, you know, Abed likes to make cameos. So we figured,
he was in a bottle episode within that office.
Yeah. It would be very meta.
So are you saying that is actually Abed?
You know what? We hadn't officially decided that, but you know, knowing Dan, he may find a way to use it.
I'm sure he'll watch the film and then he'll lose his mind.
Yeah,
so there'll be a crossover with Kickpuncher.
Yeah, Community is actually taking place in the Marvel Universe. Which, absolutely, that just blows my mind to bits. But there are other amazing Easter eggs. Did you guys take a lot of care over the inside sequence? For example, we see Stark Tower, which indicates that Tony is on the hit list, as you imagine he would be. But did you throw in any other little fun things that maybe I didn't spot? Because it's very, very quick.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of references in the film, and we forgot about them when we were working on the movie. You kind of forget about them because they... Hopefully they're working for the storytelling. You're like, oh, we need that. That's not really a reference. But then people watch the film and they go, oh, my God, Tony Stark gets name dropped. Banner gets name dropped. Stephen Strange. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of little gags, and I think we just forget about them. I have to watch the movie and then point them out.
There's a big reference to Captain America.
Yes.
Quite early on. We really rode that one as far as we could.
Yeah. But you know, Jude, you cut your design team loose, your prop master, your set decorators, you just say, put shit in there. Think of anything fun that you can think of and throw it in there.
For example, William Sadler's president from Iron Man 3, President Ellis.
Ellis,
named after Warren, I presume. But his name is given a first name in this movie, Matthew.
That's Matthew Ellis.
Are you responsible for that, or is that, again, a Marcus McFeely thing?
That was scripted, I believe.
I think they may have referred to him since... Iron Man is Matthew Ellis, not in the movie, but in their script. I think that was just something that we inherited.
There are a couple of things I just wanted to talk about very, very quickly as well with you guys. Is the return of Peggy? Yep. Was that something that was debated quite a lot? And having Hayley come back in the modern day, it's a lovely, lovely scene, especially when she forgets essentially who Steve is. The emotional impact of Steve going to the Smithsonian every day, I presume every day or fairly regularly to see. In her heyday. So was there talk about leaving it at that, or was she always going to be...
It was important to actually have her in the movie, not just sort of in a film from the past. But because of this, this movie is the first movie, even though Cap was in the Avengers, it was an ensemble. We didn't get a lot of time to really sink into a story. So this movie is the first time where we're really sort of sinking into the meaning of what it means for this man to have been... transported 70 years from his era. And it's a very profound and tragic experience in many ways, in the sense that like we all have had experiences where we lose somebody that's important to us. Well, he's lost everybody that's important to him. And we didn't want to like leave that part of his story behind. And it's always easier to play something dramatically when you have a character, you know, that you can bounce two characters up against each other rather than just looking at a screen thinking about something. So for that reason, it was very important to us to have her in the movie and to have Steve visit her and that sort of and see what's left of their relationship and see what's left of their friendship.
And it's unique to the mythology of this film. Only in this movie, we have a character who was frozen for 70 years. Could you then have him... you know, talk to his old girlfriend who is now, you know, 96. And, you know, there's great pathos in it. And the whole first act is about him searching for an identity in the modern world. And he goes to her as, sort of a meeting with the mentor to get advice about, you know, what to do with his life.
Yeah. Well, the last line of the first Avenger just killed me.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Steve saying, you know, I couldn't, you know, miss my best girl.
Right.
That was just,
I still
that broke me as well. When I overdance, that broke me as well. But in terms of moving on with Steve, and there's great chemistry between Chris and Scarlett in this movie. Was there ever talk about making Cap and Black Widow an item? I mean, obviously you have the Sharon character played by Emily Van Camp as well, And Falcon is another interesting possibility for a romantic relationship.
Yeah. That was all Mackie, by the way.
That was great.
That was never implied in the script. That was just Anthony.
I mean, look, we definitely spent a lot of time thinking about what the possibilities were in the relationship between Cap and Black Widow. And we went through months and months of sort of playing with different ideas.
But at the end of the day, it just sort of seemed like this is the, where it is in the movie is kind of where we were all led, us and Marcus McFeely and the producers. It just it felt like the right way those two would sort of be able to connect to one another.
A lot of times you let in this, and you know, when you're working on the story, you go, all right, well, what's the left turn here? What's the curveball? I mean, the obvious. You know, when there's sexual tension between two characters, the obvious is that, you know, something's going to happen. Well, what if these two are smart enough to know it would never work between the two of them? And it's, and, you know, so it really plays into more of like a work wife, work husband relationship. And you know, of course there's sexual tension between them, but I think it's just, it's more, I think she's more interested in pulling him into the modern world, and trying to, you know, help him to find that identity that he was looking for.
For example, if this was an 80s action movie, there would have been a mid second act sex scene.
Right.
Sort of that would have been inevitable. Yeah. Slow motion, billowing curtains, maybe some doves in there, who knows?
Which we did write.
You should have shot. You will, that scene, by the way, will be included on the DVD as a bonus. Yeah, no.
Maybe Falcon just flying around the room in slow motion. But the movie itself as well has been from a very early stage called The Winter Soldier. And it's very interesting because The Winter Soldier isn't really the main thrust of the story.
Right.
Can you talk about that decision?
He's the emotional thrust of the story, right? He's not the narrative thrust of the story. And, you know, we did want a larger concept at work. And clearly, you know, in order to bring down S.H.I.E.L.D., we had to involve a conspiracy. We had to have a conspiracy. Winter Soldier is a soldier. He's he's a frontline guy. As he's referred to in the movie, an asset or a weapon.
Yeah.
He's not necessarily the, you know, he's not the brains behind a, you know, a conspiracy. So, it just was a function of, you know, the structure of the film and the paranoid thriller that, that we had this vicious weapon, you know, that they would unleash. Mm. But, you know, ultimately, he's not the narrative focus.
Mm.
However, he, you know, the movie turns on the emotion between he and Cap, and probably our favorite scene of the movie is when, you know, Cap's getting his face beat by a soldier.
It's brutal, absolutely brutal.
At the end of the movie, and you know, and he falls in and goes in the slow motion, and you know, becomes very poetic, and he gets dragged on the shore with just a piano playing, and you know, that to us, that was the most important part of the movie to us. So. You know, plot is interesting. Emotion is impacting. Right?
Well, the stuff with Cap and Bucky, as I'm going to call him, rather than maybe Winter Soldiers. Do you think of him by the end as Bucky, or do you think of him as Winter Soldier? Incidentally,
well, that's a great question. Especially as we start to think about Cap 3, because it's sort of like there's these interesting I don't know if you remember the film The Searchers.
Yes,
but great John Wayne movie where about a sort of settler who's kidnapped by Indians in the American West and then sort of held for a couple of years and then stolen back to the settlers. And that's a story that wasn't uncommon in the Old West. It happened several times. And you'd have this phenomenon where the people who had been sort of taken, you know, if they were ever retrieved, sometimes they didn't know who they belonged to anymore. Their identities were kind of fractured, and they weren't quite the person they were before they were kidnapped, but perhaps they weren't fully, you know, Indian as well. So they're sort of in the middle ground, and I think that's really analogous to like where Bucky is. You know, it's sort of he had an identity that Cap was best friends with, and then he went on to have a totally different anathema identity. And it's sort of, is he that? Is he Bucky? Is he Winter Soldier? Or is he something in between?
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Well, there's another analogy for me as well, and which is Darth Vader and Luke, in a way. And I think a lot of blockbusters since Return of the Jedi have tried to replicate that great triple battle structure at the end of Return of the Jedi, but few have come close to accomplishing it. I think you guys do it with Winter Soldier. And the fight between Cap and Bucky at the end, are you intentionally riffing on Vader and Luke there? There's an awful lot, you know.
Absolutely. Look, it's funny. We're very similar to Kevin. You know, we grew up as pop culture geeks. We collected comic books. We love movies. I used to spend my Saturdays watching double feature of Hammer films and Godzilla movies and, you know. So this is, we're about as obsessive as it gets when it comes to pop culture. Just look at Community, look at Arrested Development, right? So for us, literally in the first meeting we had with Kevin, we said, you know, you've got Star Wars on your hands. You've got a villain who has as strong an emotional connection to the heroes you could possibly have. They're basically brothers.
Like Vader.
You know, they're basically brothers. So it's very operatic. And to us, that was the crux of the film. So, you know, no doubt is there, you know, a connection, because that was, you know, when Empire Strikes Back came out, I think I went to the theater at 11 a.m. and I left at 11 p.m. and I watched it, you know, 8 or 9 times. So it's ingrained in our psyche and our subconscious. So, of course, it's going to find, you know, it's going to find its way into, you know, an execution of a scene that involves, you know, family, that one is, you know, one's a hero and one's a villain. But we also wanted that brutality in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted that character to be vicious, because Cap is really Rocky Balboa, right? He's a guy with a very simple code who you just want to see win because he tries so hard to do what's right.
Mm.
And the more vicious the villain is, and the more brutal the stakes are, and the harder it is for him to win, you know, the better you feel when he finally does win.
Mm.
So it was important. Not only was the Winter Soldier such an emotional, had such an emotional impact on him, but he also beats the shit out of him.
Yeah. It's one of the things that, you know, the brutality of the movie in a way took me by surprise. And also the fact that since the Avengers, and including the Avengers, the last couple of Marvel movies have been very, very, very funny. They've been very jokey in terms of their tone. Tonally, this is very, very different. It's you know, largely very, very serious. There are obviously comedic moments, but clearly that was what you guys were looking for from the off, to maybe stand out, I guess, from the crowd and make sure that this there's no Marvel formula, so to speak, that you're falling into.
Those are the things that excite us the most. As, you know, Ant said, we like combining genre. You know, it's the incongruous elements. We like smushing them together, like Arrested, where it's absurdism and but shot realistically. You know,
Because the movie is part political thriller and part, you know, superhero movie. But the political thriller part of it is, you need real stakes. You need to feel like there's something scary happening. That there's something. That there's a tone in this world where that you can't joke around about. So any of the humor in this movie had to come from, couldn't be situational. It had to come between characters, you know? It had to just be character relationships. Which sometimes when you are in tense situations, you know, humor between characters can be very fun and electric because of the tense situation. Yeah. But I think that's the tonal shift that you're referencing there, is just the stakes of this world, the genre, the specific rules of this kind of narrative just required a more serious tone.
We're super fans of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Yeah. And, you know, I know as a fan that if I keep getting the same thing sooner or later, I'm going to get sick of it. I'm going to grow tired.
Absolutely,
of it, right?
Yeah.
So you've got to start throwing some curveballs in there. And we just felt like the tone of this movie, it was appropriate to make the choice that we did. And so why not push it as far as we could?
I've got three very quick questions. I guess we have to wrap up reasonably soon. Well, this is my friend, also called Chris, who swears blind that there's a necklace worn by Scarlett Johansson, which has an arrow on it. Would you care to comment on that?
I think,
kudos. That's the first time we've got that question. It's a very, very you have a very observant friend.
Listen, it was a choice that Scarlett made as a character, and I think it will be it will become clear her relationship with Hawkeye will become very clear, I think, in Avengers 2.
Second question: have you ever seen Condor Man?
I did see Condor Man. I haven't seen it for like 25 years.
Was it like 11 a.m. to like 2 p.m.?
Well, you know what's so funny about that is that in my mind, when we knew we had the opportunity to bring the Falcon to screen, Condor Man was one of the things that popped in my head. I was like, this guy is not going to be Condor Man. We cannot do a movie. It's hard when you've got a new character and you're dealing with, you know, the Hulk and Iron Man and Thor, these really visually dynamic and impressive characters that are, you know, mind-blowing special effects. And I'm sitting in the movie going, all right, so now what, we're going to put a guy in a glider suit, that looks like he's from a glam rock band from the 70s, talking to birds. It would have been a disaster. So on top of which, it wasn't germane to the tone of the film, which is why we took the Ultimates approach to the character, where he's militaristic and, you know, it just seemed to fit into the world better. But also we wanted, we're talking about, well, how can this guy match up? Mm. You know, what's going to make the audience excited about him and not go, where the fuck is Iron Man? We wanted to turn him into a human fighter jet, you know, give him this thrust and this grace and this beauty, and he can move quickly and stop on a dime where Iron Man has to use his thrusters to slow down. You know, he's got this grace and beauty to him, and he can weave in and out, avoid missiles, etc. So that was the approach to Falcon, and I'm just went on a crazy tangent, but it all started with Condor Man.
And where the fuck is Iron Man?
Right? Is that the last question?
Kevin, a whiskey. My final one is, did you watch the deleted scene from Avengers where you see Captain America coming to terms more with his past? Obviously he did. I don't know why I asked it that way. But you see he goes to the report of, you know, his lost love, who he wanted to dance with, and she's died. And she's died in Winchester in like 19... whenever. Were you conscious to not ape that too much? Did you draw anything from that?
You know what's interesting is I don't believe we didn't watch that scene until like after we had been working on the script for a little while.
Right.
And we had sort of, I think, worked through a lot of our Peggy issues. And then I remember somebody at Marvel said, well, you guys should just clock it, you know, and we did. But yeah, I mean, I think the thing about whether she should be alive or dead just boiled down to this idea of like really needing somebody from his past to be alive for him to actually interact with and talk to. And that's
where the movie is about, you know, as he struggles to find an identity in the modern world, you know, his old life is slipping away, is hanging on by a thread, right? Peggy doesn't, you know, her memory's slipping away. She'll be dead soon. You know, it's the last remnant of his past. You know, and Sam happens to find his way into his life. So now he's slowly meeting a new friend. He's gaining a trust with a widow. You know, so the movie's about a journey for him as he finds new elements in the modern world to emotionally attach himself to. And you know, the trick of the film, or the cruel twist is that, you know, the Winter Soldier shows up and you know, it's past punching him in the face.
Absolutely.
Could you guys tell that it was Hayley Atwell playing old Peggy?
I've interviewed her a couple of times, and her voice is very distinctive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I started thinking, no, it's not just her voice.
Yeah.
And then I clocked the mouth, I think, clocked it for me.
Right.
Yeah. It's astonishing makeup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's,
is there a bit of CG in there?
Almost all CG.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
We made the choice.
Yes.
Yeah. We wanted to do something different. You know, we wanted to try, you know, when you go down the makeup route, it kind of, you know, there's a way things have been done, but it's sort of like since all the old people look the same since the 80s when you go down the makeup route. So it's like we were trying again in a movie where you're making Captain America, a 90-pound weakling in some scenes, and using Chris Evans to do it. We thought, well, let's use Hayley to do old Peggy, and we went a CG route with it.
Thinned out her face, changed her muscle structure, all the things that would happen to you when you age.
And Tiny Steve in this movie looks phenomenal.
Yeah, it was really phenomenal.
Yeah, it looks great.
And how about that CG Stan Lee you guys had? That was that was pretty impressive.
Is that CG yet?
Enough said, true believers. Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Anthony and Joe Russo there, talking to Ali and myself. And now it's time for us to get into it big time. So, first of all, I really enjoyed this movie.
Yeah, me
I've
too.
Seen it three times. I saw it again last night with a paying audience who were really into it, including a little girl who at one point asked very loudly to the rest of the cinema, "Why is Captain America being arrested?"
It's a fair question.
It's a fair question. It's quite complicated, actually, little kid. But maybe one day we'll explain the whole thing to you. Maybe she's listening to this. So if you're listening to this, little kid, this will give you the answers you seek. I guess this is a biggest Marvel movie in terms of development, Phase 2. In terms of huge upheaval for the Marvel Cinematic Universe, in terms of what happens to S.H.I.E.L.D. in this movie.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, I think Iron Man 3 had obviously huge implications for Iron Man personally. Thor, The Dark World, you know, had big upheavals in terms of Asgard, in terms of the Nine Realms. But if we're talking right here on Earth, then this definitely moves things forward and potentially changes things a lot more than either of those two.
I mean, at the end of Thor the Dark World, Loki has assumed control of the throne of Asgard. You'd imagine that will have major ramifications going on into this. It's not even a franchise anymore. It's a
Hydra, if you will.
It's a Hydra, yeah. Many, many heads. It's a living, breathing thing, almost. And but the fact that... I love the fact that Marvel are not prepared to maintain the status quo, and they're shaking things up considerably. At the end of Iron Man 3, Tony Stark is Iron Man no more, although I've got a feeling he may get the armor back on for Avengers 2. There's huge upheavals at the end of Thor, but this is enormous. They spent a long time building up S.H.I.E.L.D. and then they've knocked it down again in one fell swoop.
Apparently the guys in the S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show, we talked about this in the interview, were somewhat stony-faced, so I can see why. It is such a rejig. It's interesting, at the end we see that everyone's favourite How I Met Your Motherer, he's now working, it looks like, for the HR department of Stark.
Or at least I think she goes into the HR department to get a job in another department.
Yeah, somewhere. Yeah. She'll be somewhere via there. I'm just curious to where she'll be. Like, is she going to be, I know, a janitor? Is she going to be in charge of alphabetizing CDs?
Janitor.
Yeah,
a furious janitor, as Dan Jolan put in the review originally. I love that he misheard that line. I'm sick of being a furious janitor.
Twice.
Twice, yes. It's also fascinating if you go back now and rewatch all the Marvel movies and all the one-shots and all the episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Mm. And you look at Jasper Sitwell, for example, Maximilian Hernandez, and you go, is he a baddin at this point? Did they, you know, I haven't spoken to Kevin Feige yet about this movie, so I haven't yet figured out whether they knew all along that he was a baddin or whether Senator Stern, played by Gary Shandling in Iron Man 2, was also Hydra affiliated, which would explain why he was such a dick to Tony Stark.
Exactly, of course
movie.
It would.
Yeah,
I think that's all become clear. I think actually this is a really good thing for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I think one of the main criticisms of that show has been that it hasn't really grappled with the fact that with the kind of the grey nature of what S.H.I.E.L.D. does. You know, by the nature of it, because you have the lovely, lovely Agent Coulson in charge of that team, you tend to associate him with S.H.I.E.L.D. and you tend to think, oh, S.H.I.E.L.D. is as lovely as Clark Gregg. How lovely. But now that you've kind of, if you kind of divorce them from that and if you take away some of their kind of resources, I think it actually makes for a more interesting show. I think this could be a really, really good thing for the TV show as well as everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it has perhaps force a TV show to become, or maybe it will force a TV show to become what it maybe should have been from the off, which
exactly.
is their kind of rogue team, or they're on the run, or they're trying to uncover massive conspiracies. And my understanding of it is that the last few episodes have begun to swing in that direction. But it would have been an interesting meeting the first time. Going, oh yeah, so we're really looking forward to planning season two. Yeah, about that, guys. It may not be a S.H.I.E.L.D. anymore. So you might just be kind of agents.
Agents of.
Yeah, agents of. Yeah, that could be quite fun.
I would like to talk about the actual plan from the perspective of Hydra. I think it's engaging because you see what they're doing. By casting Robert Redford, you feel for him and you naturally are drawn to his perspective. He is Robert Redford. So what they want to do is to save the world, is to kind of decimate it, as in the actual meaning of the word decimate,
yes.
You know, give it a haircut. The haircut they're cutting off, the hair is all the loveliest, nicest hair that can build robot stuff and is a threat to them, sure. But where they're coming from is almost believable. Now, I'm not saying I want to do this, but I thought that was interesting and brave and I liked it.
Yeah, Redford is the palatable face of evil in
exactly,
this movie.
Exactly, yeah.
And the acceptable face as well, if you will. And it's almost like Ed Harris's character in The Rock. There's a point where he says to Fury quite late on, it's like, your enemies are our enemies, Nick. And he's almost persuasive in that way, going, oh yeah, I actually can see that, you know, cut off 20 million heads and none will grow back in their place. And, yeah, that's fair enough. I can kind of see that. You have to, you know,
Break a few eggs to make your omelets.
Yeah, that's fine. Absolutely. Hell, Hydra. And I think it's a masterstroke in terms of casting Redford. And I think also in another way, it's that the Alexander Pierce character is very, very interesting. And this movie politically is more interesting than any of the previous Marvel movies. Although they could all be seen to be post 9/11 movies, I think, all the Phase 2 films. Pierce is an interesting bad guy because he is human. There's no flash or bang or tricks or superpowers with this guy. He is utterly vulnerable. At the end, he gets taken out by two bullets, by Nick Fury and not by Steve Rogers. Given their relationship together, that absolutely makes sense from a storytelling point of view. But there were a lot of rumours early on when Redford was cast. There was an internet scuttlebutt that he might be revealed to be the Red Skull.
Thank God he wasn't.
Thank God he wasn't. Because this is, for all the fact that the big battle at the end involves three massive helicarriers duking it out in the sky above Washington, for all of that, this is a fairly low-key movie. It's quite grounded, and I quite like the fact that the villain is human and fallible and doesn't have
anything to fall back on in terms of that. His grandstanding at the end is entirely verbal.
Yeah, and I like also that there is that nice, you know, there's something interesting and seductive about the idea that Hydra has been there all along. Now, it does undermine slightly the awesomeness of Agent Carter, for example, especially if they go ahead and make that TV show. It does undermine, you know, the job that Nick Fury's been doing. Like, if he's really as good as he is, he really should have picked up on something, arguably, before now. But at the same time, it's at least interesting. It's not just, oh, we've been building a robot army. It's like, oh, we've been recruiting people, actual people, in your big giant organization and using your big giant organization to our own ends, which is, a little bit more real world than many of the villains that we face in these things.
But also, if they go ahead now with the Agent Carter TV show, it could be about, you know, the Hydra conspiracy beginning right under her nose, and does she begin to uncover it?
Presumably, yeah, there's bits of it she ferrets out, but she misses
there,
others.
There are indications that Howard Stark is killed by Hydra, which is a new wrinkle. I think there's certainly areas for them to go if they do the Agent Carter TV show.
This is a film that we talked about how it compares to Iron Man 3 and Thor the Dark World. This is a film where it references and feeds into everything else. It is definitely a linchpin, right? So the reference to Stephen Strange, that's a connection, that's a thread going out. You see the Stark Tower, and obviously we talked about, H.R. Tolman. It has that feeling that I loved when you read the comics, of this all comes together. And we've talked so many times about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This is the movie that is the most, if you turn it into an adjective, Marvel Cinematic Universe, insofar as it takes all of it and makes it important. Mm. Which makes me realise why Guardians of the Galaxy is such a clever move to do next, because it gives this breathing space to let all of that settle. Yeah. Everyone watches this, they come to terms with it. Season 2 of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Guardians of the Galaxy, literally another world.
Yeah.
This is really important, and we've already made reference to what happened in Thor the Dark World. But, you know, you have to see this film. I said so in the review on the podcast. You have to see it if you care about Avengers 2, if you care about...
The one thing that doesn't quite tie in terms of that, in terms of that wider cinematic universe, is the much commented on fact, in The Office at least, that nobody calls Tony Stark while this is all going down.
Yeah.
And I think the answer to that is shut up.
I think, we have to get over that.
He retired, right?
There, you know, there's a very specific thing now where the Avengers is the Avengers, and that's the team movie, and that's where people will show up. You may get the odd thing like Chris Evans showing up very briefly in Thor 2, or Mark Ruffalo showing up as Bruce Banner right at the end of Iron Man 3, and that's great, that's fun, and that's all we're going to get. We're not going to get team-up movies. And also, frankly, in the context of where this movie sits, if this is after Iron Man 3, there's not a lot Tony Stark can do about it at the moment. So, hey, Tony, I'm in trouble. Oh, great, okay. What do you want me to do about it? I don't have any suits.
Loan you some money, or...?
Yeah, precisely. So
I bought that.
Yeah, I just kind of let, you know, there's Tony Stark does appear in the movie, kind of. You see his little silhouette in the Stark Tower as the sequence where Hydra's preparing to launch Project Insight. They're preparing to deploy the algorithm, which is my favorite line of 2014 so thus far. Deploy the algorithm. Must have spent hours in the writing room in that one.
We should have asked Professor Brian Cox about that.
Yes, we should have done.
Tell us, have you ever deployed an algorithm?
Well, I was deploying one just a few hours ago. I love all the references to this. I'm a Marvel geek. I grew up reading this stuff. You know, and quite often you read classic Marvel comics, Stan Lee Marvel comics, from Stan Lee written Marvel comics. The mentions of other characters are so gauche. They're there purely to drive people to pick up the next issue that's on sale, and so on and so forth. But here, I just love the fact that everything feels interconnected. Like, there's a throwaway reference of Stephen Strange, which is great. I love that. There's constant references to Bruce Banner. There's Stark is assisting S.H.I.E.L.D.'s tech, which I just love all these little... It feels like a real lived-in, immersive universe in a way that the glib reference to Metropolis in Batman Forever didn't.
What I loved about the Tony Stark reference in terms of the engines is obviously a big part of his arc of the second act of Avengers as him being trapped inside Iron Man. So it genuinely does really connect. It's not just a throwaway thing, as you say. It really does fit together. One thing I do want to talk about that I didn't buy and I was frustrated by was what they did with Nick Fury. I felt like it was too easy. I felt like it was a little too simple, a little too neat. Not that I didn't like the flourish. I liked the cloak being removed. But I have watched the Avengers quite a few times now, and I would like someone to possibly stay dead.
Yeah.
I kind of agree with you on this. I think what comics have been doing for years, there's a a much quoted line about comics, which is that nobody stays dead. And it used to be qualified by except for Uncle Ben. It kind of got lost after Ultimate Spidey. But yeah, nobody stays dead. And it's something, it's a problem for the form. It stops the form growing. It stops the form from being fully mature and reaching, I think, some of the potential that it has. There have to be real stakes.
Agreed.
You can't just kill somebody and have them come back 2 months later, either probably superpowered, in the cases of most men anyway, and just through science or something. It's kind of crazy. And I think you're right, Marvel is at the point where they need to kill somebody we care about. God, that sounds awful.
And keep them dead.
Narratively speaking.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, my wife, for example, doesn't watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. She didn't know. We were having a discussion last night after seeing the film, and I was like, yeah, I think one of these deaths has to really stick. Really stick. And I mean, a major character death. I mean, we'll talk about Frigga, for example, from Thor the Dark World. She's dead, she's staying dead, that's fine, but she's a relatively minor character within the
wider universe.
Within the firmament, yeah. But my wife didn't know that Coulson had come back, for example. She didn't know he was still alive. So I think for certain amount of the movie going audience, he will still be dead unless he shows up in Avengers 2. But I think absolutely, I think these deaths have to have meaning and impact. Loki in Thor the Dark World is interesting because it's very quickly revealed to us, the audience, that he's not dead. At the end of the movie, only two people in that world know that he's still alive. One is Loki, the other one is Odin, wherever he is. So that's interesting from a plot point of view. That's very, very interesting. The Fury thing, I don't know, when I saw the movie for the first time and not really knowing that much about it, I wasn't on set of this one. When he is shot, I thought, oh, this could be interesting.
Yeah.
This could be interesting. If he dies here, and part of me was actually willing to go with it. This is brave,
me
this
too.
Is bold.
I wanted Captain America to get a promotion.
Colonel America.
Yeah, I mean, it's about time.
It is about time. He's 95, for God's sake. What sort of salary does he get?
He must have a great pension, like a real cracker, like being paid both wages and a pension.
He's got a decent apartment, I guess, in Washington, so he's doing all right. I like, actually, just to talk about Captain America himself for a moment, I like that he's very much a soldier. I sound really bloodthirsty today, but I like that he kills people. You know, if they need to be killed, if they are in the way of his mission, he does kill people. Now, he doesn't set out to kill people. If you look at that fantastic opening sequence on the boat, those are actually, I think, as a non-expert, mostly disabling blows that are knocking people out. But several of those people are clearly killed.
He does kick a guy in the ocean.
He does kick a guy in the ocean.
Freezing cold ocean in the
exactly.
middle of the night. Yeah.
So, if he can't disable them and they're going to slow him down, he will kill them.
Yes.
And I think that's good because he's meant to be a soldier. He is not meant to be Superman. Not even meant to be Batman. And my slight hesitation in saying all of that is, I think, in a similar way to Superman, his job is also to save people, and therefore allowing the gigantic battles over the Potomac and over Washington at the end is perhaps something that he might have tried not to do. You might have tried to move those things out over the bay a little bit further.
Maybe, but he wasn't in control of them.
He wasn't in control of them. I know, but you know, it's one of those things.
No, but I like the film's attitude towards Steve Rogers, and it's a very, as we talked about, it's a more politically complex movie than any of the previous Marvel movies in terms of also reflecting America's place in the world. It's really interesting conversations you wouldn't expect to have in a comic book movie that's as glossy and bright as this.
Yeah.
At one point, Pierce says to one of the World Security Council members, "What happens if? What would you do if some terrorists from Pakistan invaded Mumbai, dragged your daughter into a football stadium and executed her? What would you do then?" And it's a very complex question that I didn't really expect to be addressed. It's like, okay, this is different. This is about an old school soldier from the greatest generation, as Nick Fury says to Steve Rogers early on in the film. The greatest generation, the guys who grew up very idealistic, good versus evil, black and white, good guys and bad guys. And then he's grown up in a much more complex world, a much more politically vitriolic world, and much more volatile world. And it's fascinating to see how this character navigates his way through it.
It's also worth saying that he is idealistic even by the standards of the greatest generation. That's one of the reasons that he became Captain America, that he was chosen for the Super Soldier Serum. And I think that's really interesting. You've got this super idealistic guy thrust into this incredibly grey situation with the greyest organisation possible. And that naturally makes for something much more interesting. People who have said that Stephen Rogers isn't interesting in this film, I think, are demented. I think they're just not even thinking about the situation that he's in. I think it's fascinating.
They're not taking anything he says at face value. There's a really interesting scene where he goes to visit Sam Wilson, who later becomes a Falcon, as you know, at the FIA organisation where he works. And they just have this conversation about what it's like being a soldier adapting to the post-war world, that post-war environment. And they start talking about, Sam says, well, what makes you happy? And Rogers goes, I don't know.
Yeah.
And then he says it with a Chris Evans twinkle afterwards. So you kind of, but Cap, actually, the Steve Rogers is in a fairly dark place.
Yeah.
As he would be, everything he knows is, everyone he knows is dead, everything he knows is lost, he's been dislocated through time.
And the scene of him with Peggy as well is for similar reasons, kind of heartbreaking. Another thing just about his idealism that I noticed on the second viewing of this, Cap doesn't ever lie. Even when he's talking to Alexander Pierce and he's trying to hide what Fury said to him, he absolutely tells the truth. He doesn't tell the whole truth, but he absolutely tells the truth about what Fury said. He just doesn't, mention that he also gave him a disc, for example. And I think that's really interesting, again, and just in terms of his moral code and his kind of place in the world, is that he can function in S.H.I.E.L.D., but he doesn't actually give up his own morality to do so.
I'd like to quickly talk about Black Widow here, because some of what she does in the film I thought was great. I loved her relationship with Nick Fury as the kind of, look, I'll actually get down and dirty and do this. He might be your bright-eyed boy, but I'll go and get the files. I liked her relationship with Captain America, where it's obviously they know that nothing's going to happen, and that doesn't mean that they can't have some kind of flirtation, obviously, because they have a connection, but not in the way that maybe you might have saw when he saw the pap photos of them kissing on the escalator. Right, so that's good. But what really, really frustrated me, and I brought it up as a joke with the directors, with Anthony Joe Russo, is that Jenny Agata face swap thing pissed me off. And even more than the Nick Fury dying or not dying thing, I can believe that within the science. But if we live in a world now, if we are now in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where we are in a universe where Loki, sure, he is a shapeshifter, he is a Loki, right? He's the god of mischief. She can just look like another person. That really, I think, undermines a lot of potential things. I think it is going to maybe bite them in the bum a little bit later. First of all, Jenny Agata, the British audience, I think, were like, in the room I saw it in, hundreds of people are watching it with me, and they're all going, wow, yes, oh God, yes, bam, she suddenly whips out a can of whip ass.
Throwaway gag, I don't think it's going to come into play that much. She's a super spy. Who's to say she hasn't done this before?
But this is kind of what I mean, is that this will be, you will have a situation, I think, in further films where you go, well, we need to get into him, what are we going to do, blah, blah, blah. Well, why don't you just wear a different person's face?
Maybe, but...
Maybe it's expensive.
But also, it's Mission Impossible style stuff, it's spy stuff. I'm okay with that. What I'm glad Marvel haven't done so far is introduce the horrible idea of life model decoys, although Stark does reference it in the Avengers,
but to humorous effect. Yes,
to humorous effect. But for me, that has, you're talking about people staying dead in comics, that is such a get out of jail free card over the last few years in Marvel comics. It's like, oh, I'm dead. No, it's a life model decoy. It's fine. Oh, he's turned evil. No, it's a life model decoy. Oh, it's boring.
Well, here's the other thing about Black Widow. Is at the end, she has a tribunal and
That was a little bit of a hand wave. I have to say, that whole ending of sort of, you're not going to put us in prison, it's fine.
It reminded me a bit of Iron Man 3 when it goes, whoa! And suddenly they're showing you flowers in the corner of one of the screen, and then suddenly there's a rabbit coming out of a hat in the other one, and they go, and everything's, oh, no, ooh, the next one's going to be exciting. And I kind of wanted more of Captain America, I can see how he is detached from that world. But Black Widow has definitely got...
She's got red in her ledger.
Her hands are covered in the bloody stuff.
And also, I mean, they just destroyed X number of billions of dollars worth of equipment.
Of everything.
Over the capital of the country.
Well, to be fair,
Over the Potomac. Okay, fine.
Yeah. But, so I don't think.
But that big building comes
down.
But
that big building also would cost a bob or two to rebuild.
Yeah, it's a tax deductible.
It's tax deductible.
It's fine. It's a write off.
Chris, I think we figured out why you're. I think, Chris, we've figured out why you're not in charge of the government.
No, it's fine. It's fine, guys. It's fine. It's okay.
I did love Black Widow in this. I thought she was pretty good throughout. She got stuff to do that wasn't just, you know, look pretty and look over your shoulder so we can see your tits and your arse at the same time.
Oh,
you
so
know,
there's I'm not complaining in that score either.
Okay, yeah,
it's
there was.
Fine.
Yeah.
And there was plenty of Chris Evans in a vest as well.
He was wearing a vest. That was fine too.
My wife, actually, there's nothing as gratuitous as the Chris Hemsworth tits out scene in Thor the Dark World. But
was that gratuitous? I'd have to see it again.
the moment last night where Chris Evans is in his vest in the Falcon's bedroom talking to Natasha. My wife made a noise. She actually made a noise. Like ooh. I went, what are you doing?
Presumably it just reminded you of her of you.
Yes. She went, oh my word, I didn't think there would be someone who would be less chiseled than you, Chris, she said to me. No, it was, he's all kinds of buff. But yeah, anyway, where were we? Natasha.
Black Widow.
Yeah, she's amazing in this. And, you know, not just because, you know, she handled all the action stuff well, but because I think we get a sense more in this movie of her sparkiness as well. She very much holds her own as a character, but also the fact that, you know, she's a very complex character in a way. You know, there's that really interesting scene where she and Steve are driving towards New Jersey. And by the way, how come Hydra haven't figured out that that's where they're heading? If that's, you know, I mean, there's the scene where they go to the Apple store and they plug in the SIP drive and then they track down the signal and they figure out the signal is going to New Jersey. So how come Hydra, who are so smart and so clever that they can have agents at that Apple store within minutes, don't figure out that that's what they're doing? They're not trying to
shut up.
Anyway,
more than that, if that's where the bunker of all the tech and the 70s things, whatever, here's a top tip. Mm-hmm. Put any form of defense in front of it and that's a good idea. Like a turret, maybe a laser room, or video camera.
Ah, but you see, Zola was probably in charge of all that himself, genuinely, and let them through so he could gloat like a big Nazi.
Yes.
Well, like a tiny little Nazi, actually, but you know what I mean.
I'll accept that.
Is he a Nazi? He's not a Nazi, is he? He's a Hydra. He's a Hydra.
They were super Nazis.
He's a Hydra spanner. He's a spanner, isn't he?
He is a spanner.
Anyway, Black Widow, action. Good. Well, scene, the car, driving. There's a really interesting scene where they're driving towards New Jersey and she says, you know, they're talking about, can he trust her? What sort of person is she? And she turns to him and goes, who do you want me to be? Mm. I was like, whoa, again, quite an interesting idea. It doesn't fully address, but this idea that, you know, there isn't really a Natasha Romanoff. Not really. There's a series of, you know, smoke and mirrors and deceptions. I thought it was really interesting. If she gets her own solo movie down the line, that would be really interesting to see. Can they construct a character? Can we find out who the real Natasha is? I believe Avengers 2 will see a lot of that explored as well.
Also, Avengers 2 will explore where Hawkeye is. We're wondering, oh, where's Iron Man? But really, who's the person who actually works in S.H.I.E.L.D. and is a very good shot and is, you know, essentially Black Widow's best buddy?
Yeah, he's probably training Katniss for the Hunger Games 3. Yeah. I don't know.
I flat out asked the Russo brothers in a video interview, which you can see on the website, and I said, where is Hawkeye? Probably preparing for Avengers 2.
That's not an answer, that's a cop-out.
It is a cop-out.
That's a cop-out.
Essentially, what they said to me is that within Avengers 2, it will be revealed where he is now. Right. Can we talk about the...
We can talk about whatever you want.
Please, can we talk about the final, not the final credits thing, but the main credits thing?
Oh, we move in there and we go in there.
Well, I just want to ask about that because we're talking about Avengers 2 and I'm talking about where is Hawkeye right now. And we have this ending. At the risk of revealing my ignorance too much, what is going on there?
All right. My understanding of it is that this is a Hydra base of some kind and we meet Baron von Stucker, who played by Thomas Kretschmann, who is a classic... Not that classic, but he was a traditional Captain America bad guy. Hydra still have Loki's scepter, which presumably was put into S.H.I.E.L.D. storage, and then Hydra got it because of their tendrils. And now they're using the energy from Loki's scepter from the first Avengers to carry out experiments on people that will turn them into superpowered beings. And most people have died in those experiments, save two. And the two are Pietro and Wanda, a.k.a.
the twins, a.k.a. The twins.
Yes, Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch.
I did not work that out at all. That is very interesting to me.
It helps me. You've seen it three times.
Yeah.
It really does. Von Stucker even says so to that effect.
Do you see other people who have died?
But they reference it in the dialogue.
He says their bodies will be buried so deep even their ghosts won't be able to find them.
And they want to create superheroes to rival the Avengers
for Hydra, presumably.
For Hydra,
yes,
right.
I think the interesting thing about this is it shows Marvel's economy again a little bit, and I don't mean that in terms of their penny pinching, but in terms of their storytelling, which is that their MacGuffins, they're kind of reusing. We've already sort of seen in the credit sting to Thor: The Dark World that the MacGuffins from both Avengers and Thor 2,
the Tesseract,
yes, and the Aether, are also giant mega meta MacGuffins.
The Infinity Stones.
They are also the Infinity Stones, which are part of the Infinity Gauntlet, which is what Thanos, who's the guy we saw at the end of Avengers, stay with me now, is trying to assemble.
Hang on. Start from the very beginning.
So when it says Avengers assemble, it literally means the Avengers are assembling a bunch of different MacGuffins so they can stick it into a glove that makes the big man go.
They
boom.
Don't want to stick it in a glove.
Oh, right.
They want to keep them as far apart as possible. That's why at the end of Thor 2, you had Sif and...
Falstag
delivered one of them, the Aether, to the Collector, who we'll see in Guardians of the Galaxy.
But he already has one.
They already have one. Oh, yes, he already has one as they turn, but they didn't know that.
Yes.
But anyway, they're trying to keep them apart. And anyway, he's crazy powerful, so they're hoping that he can keep them from Thanos anyway.
So it should be Avengers dispose of the MacGuffins, but...
But you can't dispose of the MacGuffins, as we've already seen in Thor: The Dark World. The Aether cannot be destroyed for reasons that...
Reasons.
I think the next movie should be called, in Britain at least, Avengers Disassemble.
Yes.
2.
Yes.
Because then it would make more sense.
It would make more sense.
So what I'm saying is Loki's staff, which was just a thing to control the what's it in Avengers, is now also a thing that creates stuff in Avengers 2. That's economy.
I am amazed by his staff. I think Loki should have been doing more of that a long time ago if it had the power to turn people into super beings. But anyway,
when you say Loki's staff, I keep thinking he's the owner of a small business.
I don't think he is. The characters of the twins.
Okay.
Sure.
Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver.
Yes, Elizabeth Olsen is Scarlet Witch. Aaron Taylor Johnson is Quicksilver. They are about to play husband and wife in Godzilla, and now they're playing brother and sister. It's slightly icky. Let's hope they don't forget which is which, boys and girls. They're complicated, aren't they, Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch? Because these are the two characters that that Marvel and Fox have claims to. So we're going to see Quicksilver in X-Men Days of Future Past, a very different one played by Evan Peters, also formerly of Kick-Ass, but we're not going to see Scarlet Witch. No, at least I don't think we are.
No. She's always been more associated with Avengers. I remember Quicksilver has turned up in more X-Men comics than Scarlet Witch. Scarlet Witch has been very, very closely associated with the Avengers over the years. A very odd character who at one point had a nervous breakdown and completely changed the entire Marvel Universe, which was a fascinating story. House of M and... what's the second part of that?
House of N?
M from Magneto.
No, but was the second one N?
No, it's... Hang on.
House of No, there was House of
Fraser.
No, sorry, this is really going to annoy me. Let me look it up quickly.
The Jack built.
Cards.
House MD. First House M, then House MD.
Okay, so in House of M and Decimation, she basically depowers 90% of the world's mutants for reasons that are way too complicated to go into. But she can basically change reality, and her powers are very near limitless. And so you get this, in that, you had this big debate about can we kill her to stop her doing anything else, because she's cray cray. So she's a very, very powerful figure. She is obviously a mutant. They are both the children of Magneto in the comics. We're not going to mention that in the Avengers universe because Fox has the rights to that bit of their hit backstory.
What is she doing? Is it just telekinesis that we see in the room?
No, she changes reality.
Whether that's the case in Avengers 2, I don't know.
Sure, it's unclear.
What we see from the film in the tiny...
She's floating things around and possibly making them blink in and out of existence.
Yeah, she's... But at the end, she takes a block and crushes it in some way. Whether she makes it completely disappear or whether she destroys it, who knows? But, she seems to be the more formidable foe. They're being set up as foes for the Avengers. The pap shots we've seen, or you may have seen... of the early stages of shooting on Age of Ultron from Italy, show them seemingly working with Hawkeye, unless he's turned bad again. I imagine at some point they'll turn good, because that's kind of their arc. They started off as badens in the comic, and then they became goodens. But Pietro, and it's interesting that actually they're being called Pietro and Wanda, as far as I'm aware, in Avengers 2, because in Days of Future Past, Pietro is Peter, so they've changed that.
it's interesting that they're keeping, well, hopefully maybe keeping their personalities, because Pietro in particular is a bit of a dick. He's arrogant. The world moves in slow motion for him. He's super, super fast. So he just has no patience whatsoever. And he's very, very cold and detached. So it's going to be interesting to see if that happens. And Scarlet Witch ends up marrying... this is where it gets complicated. Strap yourself in, kids. She ends up marrying the Vision, who's one of my favorite characters, certainly from a visual standpoint, who is an android created by Ultron. Okay? Who, again, starts off as a bad one, but then becomes part of the Avengers. And they become one of the sort of fulcrum couples, I guess, of the Avengers in many ways. But Ultron in the comics is created by Hank Pym, who becomes Ant-Man, Giant Man, but that will not be the case in the MCU. We suspect it'll be Tony Stark who creates Ultron.
Right, so that clears that up then.
I don't know if it did it?
We're thinking that Jarvis might be the Vision.
It seems to be the way. The fact that Paul Bettany is playing the Vision and he has been the voice of Jarvis for 4 movies now would indicate that's going to be the case.
I like the idea that he makes the Vision and that's his android. He goes, I'm doing really well with this, because that's kind of, he can't build suits because he's been banned by Pepper from doing that. So he makes this android and that becomes the Vision, right? And then he goes, I can do one better, then accidentally creates Ultron.
Uh-oh.
That's how I'd see it.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
I think it's quite interesting that they're shooting in South Korea. They're shooting a lot of the first section of Avengers Age of Ultron in South Korea, because it is increasingly one of the biggest film markets out there. It's equal, just as big as the UK these days. Fun facts.
Fun Absolutely. Facts from Ali. We should definitely have a theme tune for your fun facts, I think.
Fun fact.
Yeah, they're also shooting in Italy, they're shooting in South Korea, and they're shooting in the bulk of it over here in the UK. Ha ha. Praise God and God save the Queen. And where else are they shooting? They're shooting in Johannesburg as well, so that's very fun. Another core relationship in the film is Captain America and the Falcon.
And do you know what? Like, I may have said this in the main podcast, but honestly, every beat of their relationship is exactly like a romance, you know. Seriously, they've got the meet cute running along. Then they bond over some spurious shared history, and then it's all like, oh, I'm in real trouble. I just turned up at your door because you were the only person I could think to go for help. And he's all like, sure, use my shower. I mean, come on, yeah. People. And I think it works well for together. Just, you know, using that sort of shorthand to create a kind of a friendship quite quickly, but honestly, they are the couple in the film. Oh, I tell you what else is interesting about the Black Widow relationship. During that conversation in the car to New Jersey, she asks him, you know, was that your first kiss since 1945? And he says, I'm 95, I'm not dead. Mm. Which would seem to perhaps put an end to the is Steve Rogers still a virgin questions.
What's the answer then?
Well, I'm assuming maybe not. At least he's kissed a girl, so let's just give him the benefit of the doubt and assume
he doesn't say girl.
Ooh.
Does he? It's interesting though that he spends the entire movie turning down exhortations from Natasha to ask women out. The entire movie.
Hey, it would be a great political statement if Captain America's gay.
What about such and such from statistics? No, I'm not interested. What about such and such? What about your next door neighbour who's really, really hot? No.
What about this? What about this one armed cyborg man who you have history with?
Yeah.
How about
dreamy
him?
Eyes
he was
hair.
Looking dreamy.
A lot of makeup, eye makeup on. Can we talk about... I can't help but think of that Adam Buxton sketch where he shouts the phrase, it's a fucking falcon, Richard. every time Falcon's on the screen. I actually love his get-up. I like the way they incorporated this real-life bit of tech and how he's not obviously dressed up in a big red and white yoga suit, as he calls it. And he doesn't actually talk to birds. That's a positive decision, I think. I like Anthony Mackie. You've heard him on the podcast
before.
So hang on,
sorry.
He's a very funny guy.
I just want to interrupt you there. So Captain America...
Yeah.
Turns down dates with girls throughout the movie.
Yes.
And the Falcon doesn't like to talk to birds. It's another clue.
We've solved it, guys.
It's another clue. Let's certainly wrap that up. I'm sure there was something else that we wanted to talk about.
There's loads of things. Yeah, the Falcon, his appearance. I've seen, there's not a lot of criticism of this film on Twitter at the moment. A lot of people seem to like it. It's in the 90s at the moment on Rotten Tomatoes. Not that that's a measure of anything. But one of the few things I have seen criticised about it is the Falcon's appearance, which I really liked.
I think it's really good.
I liked his get-up. I liked his suit.
What else are you going to wear if you're wearing a wingsuit and flying about the place? I mean, come on, people.
And I thought the effects were pretty good on the old Falcon. Flying is notoriously difficult to get right. It can often look cheesy and CG, but I really liked it. We mentioned the Winter Soldier. The film is called Winter Soldier, which is really, really interesting wrinkle, because I don't think it's about him. The Russo said he is the emotional antagonist in a way. He drives the plot. I think they could have maybe called it something else. Having said that, I thought, what do you think of the character?
I liked him. Obviously, I thought he looked hot, as I said. But also, I think it's an interesting setup. And the fact that they sort of can erase his memory each time they wake him up for a job is an interesting one. You know, that sort of befuddlement on his face and that feeling that he should know this guy is quite heartbreaking. And of course, he does get the kind of the last word, that post-credit sting. Is him going back to the Smithsonian and sort of looking up at himself and I think kind of beginning to put some pieces together that he didn't really have in his head. It was almost more of a setup, wasn't it, for the next Captain America, really, in terms of him than anything else. But you've got to hope for a redemption for poor Bucky.
Having said that, I really enjoyed the relationship. Nick isn't here. Nick the Smithsonian isn't here. And he, I think, in the office was more vocal about the fact that he didn't remember Sebastian Stan for Bucky from the first movie whatsoever. So,
what?
Yeah, he's not the first person who said that to me either. So he says whenever it was revealed at the end that the Winter Soldier was Bucky, he was kind of like, well, what? It's not a relationship I particularly remembered or cared about or was invested in, so it didn't have an emotional impact for me. And I think that's a fair point to make. Having said that, I think the movie does quite a lot of nice work in the last third to sell that emotional impact. And Chris Evans does some of his best work in the scenes near the end where he's confronting Bucky and he's like, don't make me do this, don't make me kill you. And then at the end where he's completely passive and he's like, basically you can beat me to death, I'm not going to do anything to lay a finger on you. But there's that really nice scene where in the 1940s after Steve's mother has died, there's that repeated line, I'm with you until the end of the line, which he says later on. It's just a nice little touch, and that actually, you know, kind of got me a little bit in a way that the Peggy scene got me as well. You know, that this is a man who has lost everything, and you know, he's confronted in a very real way with that loss when he's sitting next to CG Peggy.
I really wish they just got another old lady. I love Hayley Atwell.
I thought that was great.
Look,
that took me by surprise, the revelation about the CG.
We've had conversation about this, and I respect that you like it, and I think that's great. And I wish that I was into it, but I actually just, it was peculiar. Her teeth were those false teeth, fake thing, and I know obviously that's what old ladies have, but I found myself staring at different parts of her face and not actually listening to what she was saying.
Well, maybe it's because it's CG. Maybe there's an uncanny valley thing there that hasn't quite got over. But
I didn't know it was CG. That's
the thing.
Quite,
I think if you ask most people, you'll say that it's prosthetics, or maybe it's another actress with Hayley Atwell's voice topped on. The fact that CG, it's pretty astounding. Watched it again last night, knowing it was CG, and could not see the joints.
Well,
really couldn't see the joints.
I could for some reason, unfortunately. But anyway, that's my opinion, and I'm glad that other people don't.
So that scene itself is interesting, because even though it moved me, the idea at the end when she coughs and she's clearly 94, 95 herself, and you know, she coughs and she forgets Steve and she's almost seeing him for the first time. And that's quite heartbreaking. But there was part of me that kind of wished they hadn't had that scene at all. There's something really poignant about the idea that Steve goes to the Smithsonian. You'd imagine almost every day just to see his lost love on a video screen.
And when Natasha asks who she is when she sees her picture in the base,
he doesn't respond.
And he just can't even deal with it. I actually like the first part of the scene with her being Sparky, and I get why they have the second part where she forgets him, that emotion of seeing him for the first time again, but it kind of, I wanted her to be a kick-ass old lady as well as a kick-ass young lady, I guess. So I sort of almost wished that
had been a kick-ass old lady, then all sorts of thoughts of like, go on, just go for it, Steve.
Oh my god, stop now.
Would have entered your head. Certainly they would have entered mine.
Lots of little fun kind of Easter eggs and references. Nick Fury's tombstone is a thing of abiding beauty. Pulp Fiction fans will immediately have twigged. Basically, in the screening I was at with lots of critics, there was a lot of laughter at that. But it is Ezekiel, is it 25:17, which he quotes in Pulp Fiction, which is mentioned on his tombstone, and that's wonderful.
I think some of the fight choreography, you know, we're living in almost in a post Raid world at the moment, and it still does smack you in the face when you're watching an action scene and you clearly know it's not the actress involved, or they're still doing that juddery quick cutting thing, finesse some of the shonkier action. And it's a bit of a shame the fight between Batroc and Captain America early on isn't as good
but I think most of the action is actually
really good. I think actually the assassination attempt on Fury is a clear and present clearly inspired by Clear and Present Danger, and it's a Clear and Present Danger level action scene. The scene in the lift is fantastic. That's a great, great fight scene. And I really like the stuff later on when they're on the bridge, and it's Winter Soldier attacking all three of them, and there's different things going on, and you know, it's good stuff. I think the action in this movie, is, like I say, it's not choreographed as well as it could have been, but it still delivers for me.
Yeah, me too.
George Seabrook, you sent me a tweet saying that I should mention that this Baltrock fight was like something out of Street Fighter. So I have.
Fair enough. I can see why people might say that. Also, someone, I don't know your name, sorry, but they tweeted the Empire account going yesterday saying, how could Arnim Sola have brainwashed Bucky if he was captured on the same train from which Bucky fell? Now, that's an interesting idea, because obviously you're thinking, well, it's post-war, sure, whenever he's insinuated himself into S.H.I.E.L.D. / Hydra, and he can go off and do his own thing, and that's okay.
Oh, but he's frozen for ages, right?
You can say he's frozen for ages, but the movie does seem to strongly insinuate that it's almost immediate.
Sorry, no, I think what they're insinuating there is that they did some of the preliminary work on Bucky, not Buffy, sorry, when he was captured before. You remember that Captain America, prior to the train sequence, has rescued Bucky. I keep saying Buffy. Has rescued Bucky from a Hydra prisoner of war camp. That comes before the train sequence in Captain America in the first one. And it's during that time he actually finds Bucky in a room strapped to a sort of table where he's clearly been experimented on in some way. We don't really know what it is at the time. The implication now is that that was the sort of first stages of his Winter Soldier training. So yeah, that's why he was able to survive the fall from the train and then was worked on by either the Soviets or the Germans or whoever the heck. But so those archive pictures of Armin Zola working on him must have come from that time before Cap rescued him
but
in the first place.
The flashback that Bucky himself has to Arnim Sola going, hello, Mr. Barnes, we will now cut off your arm and make you evil.
Well, that would be the post stage once he's working with Hydra inside.
But it seems to
S.H.I.E.L.D.
be
again,
just immediately after his fall. So there might be a slight
thing
happening there. But maybe, you know, we'll see. If you ever get, you know, we'll ask Feige. I'll see what he says.
Okay, he'll know all.
He'll know. Maybe he'll go, shut up, you know too much, and then kill us. Okay, right. So anything else? Anyone want to talk about anything else? The ending, I mentioned it on the interview with Russo, the Russo brothers. You know, again, this has come in for a little bit of flack because it's something huge, but I quite like the fact that it's one of the few movies of the last 30 years that actually tries to ape the Return of the Jedi model of flitting between different characters doing different things, and actually kind of succeeds. There are a couple of direct references to Return of the Jedi. Obviously, when Captain America and the Winter Soldier face each other, that's very Darth Vader versus Luke, and there's a bit of the Emperor in there as well. And there's a cut from the Falcon. There's a cut from the Falcon in midair with lots of explosions around him to Alexander Pierce in the Triskelion watching the battle, which is very, very the Emperor watching the space battle. But yeah, I quite like this stuff, and there's enough character moments going on within all the big CG nonsense to make it work for me.
I agree. Again, as well as needing to kill somebody and make it stick, I do think that Marvel needs to at some point find a way to do a film where the last act isn't the big giant fight scene. I mean, World War Z managed it, so maybe there is a way to do that in a big action blockbuster without leaving us feeling left down by it. But having said that, I actually don't mind bigger action scenes in a general sense. So while there is a risk of being repetitious, and I think that's what they need to avoid, this one wasn't a bad one.
Agreed. And we have banged on now longer than we intended to. But that's because I think, you know, there's a lot to talk about. And we dig this movie the most, man.
We totally dig it.
Which is a reference Captain America might want to write down in his little 70s notepad.
Whether it's the English version or the Chilean version or the French version and the Spanish version.
That stuck in my craw a little bit.
They all have different versions. It's a publicity thing. And I kind of think it's cute. I kind of think it's weird. Personally, I'm very on the cute side. It's nice that Sean Connery gets mentioned in a
Marvel movie. Why would Captain America be wanting to check out the World Cup final from 1966?
Because somebody mentioned it once and he had no idea what they were saying.
But he doesn't know what football is.
Yeah, he has to look that up too.
I'm not so sure about that. Anyway, there we go. Captain America, the Winter Soldier. That is it for this spoiler special. The next spoiler special will be for The Amazing Spider-Man 2. We'll be having Avi Arad, Matt Tomac and Mark Webb on that one as well, and then it's going to be followed by Godzilla and X-Men Days of Future Past, and then Mrs. Brown's Boys, the movie. Until then, It is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Ali.
Helen.
Helen.
Ali.
Ali.
Hello.
And it's goodbye from me.
Hail Hydra.